I could summarize Genesis's message by saying that Genesis 10 and 11 tell us that all world religions come from Babylon and the Tower of Babel. The Bible says there was no idolatry serving false gods before Noah's flood. Genesis 11 and the Tower of Babel is the start of religion. There are two forms of looking at God. The first one is what I call divine accomplishment, that God did everything you need to have done to be saved. So God says, I did everything, all you have to do is receive it as a gift. Satan says, no, you humans need to achieve, work, earn your own salvation. Basically, God gives revelation, he reveals truth. Satan offers religion, which are ways to earn your way to heaven. Every religion has the same components of working, earning, achieving your way to God. God's revelation always says he accomplished everything needed, and all we have to do is believe him. In fact, we'll see next week that there are two chapters in Revelation that talk about the two parts of Satan's global religion. Either Satan has everybody involved in religion, that's Revelation 17, or Satan has everybody involved in materialism, which is Revelation 18. And in chapter 17, God destroys the world religion, and in Revelation 18, he destroys the commercial, money-driven materialism of the world. Now, for a moment, back up and look at all seven of the churches with me. Not only were the churches in literal places of Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamos and Thyatira and Sardis, Philadelphia and Laodicea, each church in order also parallels the history of the church. Ephesus is like the early church while the apostles were still alive. And Smyrna portrays the period from AD 60, the first persecution, through AD 300, the final persecution year. And Pergamos illustrates the marriage between paganism and the true church that took place when the Roman Catholic Church started. And Thyatira is the entire time up to the Reformation, what was going on as the church became more and more corrupt. And Sardis portrays much of what was going on, especially in Europe, when the church had a name but was very dead. But it's interesting, Philadelphia portrays the time of what we would call the modern missions era, when the organized churches started sending missionaries to every part of the world. And evangelists like the Wesleys and Dwight Moody and Billy Graham began to preach all over the world. But in many ways, the church is becoming like Laodicea, where the church is rich and increased in everything, but doesn't need God. But the seven churches also portray the seven different kinds of Christians that are in every church. In every church today, in fact, in this room this morning, some of you are like the Ephesians. You're distracted from what you used to be serving the Lord. And some of you are like the people in Smyrna. You are right now going through the fire of persecution at home or somewhere, and you're being refined. And I'm sure in a group this size, there is someone like a Pergamite who is secretly hiding and committing and continuing in sins that no one knows about but God. And there are always people in every church that are believing wrong things, and they need someone to keep them from being deceived by some false doctrine they've heard. And there are people like those in Sardis that were stupefied, they were asleep, they just kind of were not even conscious of what the Lord was doing. But the blessing are those Philadelphian Christians. They're impassioned about the Word of God, about saving are sharing the gospel and seeing people saved, they're passionate. And then there are always those uncommitted Christians that just kind of go to church, but they really aren't into this. And the message to every type of believer is always the same. Jesus, from the beginning, said Christianity is following him. And Ephesians 2 tells us Satan's always empowering the lost people of this world to go his direction. And one of the most interesting things is that all world religions have an element that denies the reality of a creator God that we're responsible to. In fact, who do you think invented the idea of evolution? See, Satan wants to put God way out in the distance so you don't have to worry about ever meeting him. Now, I put that address up there once more because from this moment onward, if you haven't downloaded the notes, it's going to be too fast for you to write down. Basically, the church at Pergamos tells us how Satan entered into what we would call Christian religion. The last epistle John wrote, 1 John chapter 5, says, "Church, beware of idols." Abraham, the father of faith, used to be an idol worshiper. That's what Joshua 24, 2 and 3 says. Jeremiah 44 introduces us to a person called the Queen of Heaven. Do you know what the Roman Catholic Church calls Mary? Mary, in the Vatican in Rome, is portrayed and called the Queen of Heaven. And she sits next to Jesus and tells him what to do. Where would that have come from? Well, in the time after the flood, there was a woman called Semiramis. And she had a son who was killed by wild animals and his body was all torn up. And she mourned him for 40 days. And at the end of 40 days, he rose from the dead. And by the way, her son was divinely conceived. A sunbeam from the sky touched her, and she bore a son. And that son died, and he was buried and mourned for 40 days. And after 40 days, he rose from the dead. Have you ever heard of the Christian holiday called Lent? In fact, in Brazil, they celebrate part of this in something called the Carnival. There's a celebration called Mardi Gras, which means Fat Thursday, before Ash Friday, which starts the 40 days leading up to Easter of Lent. And every Roman Catholic church in the world follows that schedule. Awesome. Have you ever wondered where the beads of the Roman Catholic Church and the robes of the Roman Catholic Church and the candles of the Roman Catholic Church and all of the Pope headdresses that the popes wear on top of their heads, have you ever wondered where all that stuff came from? There was a time when the church was just what you read about in the New Testament. After Diocletian almost destroyed the church for those persecutions where he killed the pastors, destroyed the buildings, and destroyed the Bibles, Diocletian retired. He couldn't destroy the church, so he quit. He had a real problem. He would send his Roman legionaries. They would round up all the Christians. They'd take them to the edge of the cliff. They would get them on the edge, and the Christian would turn and say to the soldier, "I'm going to heaven. Are you?" And he'd push them off. And the soldiers would be chaining and tying the people to these stakes and piling the sticks around them, ready to burn them, and they would be sharing their hope in Jesus Christ and preaching the gospel. And by the time of Constantine, the next emperor, they were losing ground. Their soldiers were becoming Christians. And Constantine said, "Hey, if you can't beat them, join them." Rome had a concept called pantheon. Pan means all in Greek, and theon means gods. And in the center of Rome, if you ever go there today, there is a pantheon still standing, a building. And all the way around the pantheon there were little places for every god of every people and every country that Rome ever conquered, and they just took their god and put it in that building and said, worship all of the gods. So Rome had a religion from coast to coast, the whole empire. Worship all the gods of all the different countries, but the emperor was the top god. And Rome had thousands and thousands and thousands of priests that led all this pantheonic worship. And the priests had beads they wore, and they prayed and held the beads as they prayed. And you always were different than normal people when you were a priest, and you wore a certain outfit, a special uniform to be a priest. And while you did your beads and did your robe, you burned candles and did all these religious things. And then there were, in every corner of the empire, New Testament local churches. Like you read about in the New Testament. Corinth, Ephesus, Philippi, Thessalonica. And Constantine noticed that there were more and more and more and more Christians, even among his legionnaires, his soldiers. In fact, one Roman lawyer, his name was Tertullian, said, the blood of the martyrs has become the seed of the church. The more of them we kill, the more of them spring up. So Constantine said, okay, we've got this whole pantheonic worship all over the empire, and we have this other emperor named Jesus Christ with his whole group all over the empire. So he said, let's just put them together, and we'll make the Roman Catholic Church. Catholic means universal. So this is the Roman Church of all the gods. This is what was called the Holy Catholic Universal Church of Christ and the Apostles. And what they ended up with when they put them together was the Roman Catholic Church.
You got it.
That instead of an emperor or Christ would have a pope. In Pergamos, there was a priest of the pantheon called the Pontifex Maximus. That was his title. And he worshiped at an altar that the Romans thought came right from Babylon. And he wore a great big hat on his head that was called a tiara and a mitre, and he led the worship of the pantheon with that title. And Pontus means bridge, and Maximus means the biggest bridge. That was what his title was. And it was such a nice title that the Roman emperor took that title, and he became called the Holy Roman Emperor of the pantheon, the Pontifex Maximus. Today, the Brazilian, or is he Argentinian? Who's the Pope? Yeah, he wouldn't be Brazilian, no. The Argentinian Pope calls himself the Pontifex Maximus today. Every Pope has called himself that since Constantine merged the two. That's what happened in Pergamos. Constantine polluted Christianity by merging the two. And basically, I tell people when I teach that there are seven reasons why I'm not a Roman Catholic. And the first one is that they have made Mary the co-mediator with Christ. Now, I'm not talking about your friend that's Roman Catholic. I'm talking about the official doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. They say Mary sits next to Jesus, and if you pray to Mary, she hears what you say, and she tells him what he should do. Secondly is the Mass. The Mass, Roman Catholic Mass, is when a priest re-sacrifices Jesus Christ. In fact, the priest will take the host, and he will hold it in front of the church and say, Hoc est corpus meum. And the Roman Catholic Church teaches that the normal bread made by some baker, as the priest holds it, and lifts it up, turns into the actual body of Jesus Christ. The actual Latin words are hoc est corpus meum, which means this is body mine. And what's interesting is in the Dark Ages, farmers in Europe would come to church and a priest would go, hoc est corpus meum. And that bread amazingly changed into Jesus right in front of them. That came into the English language as something called hocus pocus. Kind of like, what's that little boy with the glasses called? What's his name? The one from the movies? What do you say? Oh, yeah, Harry Potter. There we go. I forgot his name because I don't like him, but Harry Potter. Harry Potter and all this magic stuff is where the Dark Ages, they thought you could do hocus pocus. If the priest could change bread into Jesus, maybe we can change stones into gold. Another thing the Roman Catholic Church does is they venerate saints, and they wear medals, like, around their neck of Saint Christopher. I don't even know who they are, but it's like if you wear the one when you travel, he will keep you safe. In fact, there's a Roman Catholic cathedral that has every one of the saints represented in the cathedral, and they all have their own little altar that you can come to. And if you pray at this altar to St. George, he will make sure your son, who is in war on the other side of the world, is safe during the battle if you will pray to St. George right here. The Roman Catholic Church ascribes to Mary and the saints the ability to be omnipresent. If I talk to George in this cathedral, George can go help anyone, anywhere in the world at any time. That means George has to be able to be omnipresent. That's an attribute of God. Mary, sitting next to Jesus, needs to be able to, at any moment, hear any person, alive or dead, she gets both, and hear them all at once, understand them all, and communicate it to Jesus. That's omniscience. When a person is holding their rosary and praying through their rosary, Mary can hear all of them at once. I could go through a lot more, but do you understand what I mean? This is not Christian at all. So as we get to the fourth church, Jesus is continuing to tell us what he's seeing. The fourth church, to the angel, the messenger, the pastor, the star in the hand of the church in Thyatira, these things, and look at Jesus' title. He starts repeating what John saw in chapter 1 on the island of Patmos. Jesus has these eyes that can pierce through and see everything, and feet that are glowing like brass in a furnace. And Jesus says, I see you're doing some really good things for me. However, there are problems. And then he starts talking about what we were talking about 2 days ago, the chastisement of Christians continuing in sin. But no matter how far away from the Lord they had gotten, do you remember? But to you, I say, and the rest, as many as not known, he says, I am telling you, you can come back to me at any time. And then look how he signs every letter. He that has an ear, hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. What he's saying is we have a choice every day. We can repent, we can come back, and we can serve Christ or not. Now, Thyatira was a very hard place to live for Christ. Basically, Jesus had a plan for every church. He picked out one thing that he knew was going on in that church. More than any other church, Thyatira had something going on that was terrible. In the Roman world, they had what were called trade guilds, trade organizations. And if you were a person who built statues like the silversmiths of Ephesus, that made little images of the gods, you were part of like what we would call today a union, a trade organization that worked together. They were called guilds or unions. It's still that way in America, the idea of trade guilds and unions. If you're a carpenter and you build houses on your own, you could charge $20 an hour, but if you're part of the guild or the union, you would get $50 an hour. So which one would you like if you're raising a family? Do the same work, and you get 2.5 times as much for the very same work. The only problem is, if you joined the trade guild, you had to go into this alluring, sinful cesspool to be a part of this guild. Tied to the worship of the gods of Rome were the trade guilds. The Roman gods, if you know anything about mythology and the pantheon of Roman gods, one of their central parts of worship was sexual relations. So in Thyatira, if you were in a trade guild, once a week you had to come to the meeting of all the carpenters. Other days they had a meeting of all the silversmiths and the bricklayers. Whatever you did, that you had a meeting every month or every week at the temple. And in Thyatira, the archaeologists have found the minutes, the notes of what went on in these trade guild meetings once a week. The first thing is, all the men only came to these, the men all laid on couch beds for the meal. Each man had his own couch and his own waitress that served the meal to him. And she would sit on his couch and she'd feed him his food and she'd hand him his wine. And as the meal progressed, she slowly undressed and kept feeding him his food and giving him as much as he wanted to drink. If you were a carpenter and wanted to earn more money, you got to lay on that couch once a week with that pretty slave girl who would feed you and give you as much wine as you could drink and anything else you wanted. Did you notice what the letter says Jezebel was doing to people in that church? She was seducing them to commit immorality. What happened was, what was going on with all the unbelievers in normal life had moved into the church. You know, what's interesting is not much has changed. Jesus still says we're supposed to live a holy life. We are supposed to be living today based on what Jesus did for us in the past. Like Jesus said to Thyatira, what we should be seeking is not to earn more money or to have more pleasure, but to have Jesus Christ approve our lives. You know, probably the best illustration in the Bible of what was going on in Thyatira is the strong man we know by the name of Samson. Samson portrays a believer who allows himself to get involved in the sins of the world. And Paul describes this in 1 Corinthians 3:15 and said there are actually people that will get to heaven, but they will end up with no rewards and suffering loss. And Samson shows us how to do that. If you read in Judges 13, and all these scriptures aren't in your notes, you have to add them. In 13:1-25, Samson knew the truth and walked away from it. If you've ever been to Israel, it's so clear. When you stand where Samson lived, you can see what he did. Samson lived up on the hill in a place called Zorah. And right at the edge of the horizon were where the Philistines lived. And while he was up in Zorah, he looked at all the girls, and the Jewish girls didn't look very pretty. But boy, those Philistine girls were really pretty. So Samson disobeys his parents and starts dating a pagan Philistine girl. And so Samson, if you remember, had been dedicated to the Lord by his parents. And he was a Nazarite. And so he was never supposed to cut his hair and never supposed to drink alcohol and never touch anything dead. And he broke all those rules, and it led to disaster. Do you remember when the Lord looked at this church, he said, some of you are dead, and it's time for break. Some of you are dead. Get up, move around, let's go.